I know it's not easy sometimes to come out on Wednesday. We're tired. Work week drains us. It's hard to get outside the house if you've been settled for a bit. So I thank you for the sacrifice you make and making your way here faithfully each week. I appreciate that so much. We have just sung two songs, which I consider Keanu Reeves songs. You know Keanu Reeves from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Speed, other things. He was known for his earliest movies to always use the word somewhere in a movie, whoa. You know, whoa, that's wow. And that's what those songs are. They're songs we need, songs of praise, songs of indescribable. You are beyond imagining and beyond fathoming, God. They are songs that take us to a place where we realize that the God we approach is greater than we can possibly imagine or perceive. That God that is the deepest mystery and yet invites us to deep relationship. And that mystery is no more profound than in the passage we're looking at tonight from Matthew 17. That passage that I would gather most of you are familiar with, this thing called the Transfiguration. This pivotal moment in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, for all three Gospels record this event, and that itself is important because it means for the early church this was a very significant revelation of Jesus. You have this occasion where all of a sudden the veil is pulled back and the glory that's always been there, that's always been resident within Christ, is now visible for at least three of his closest disciples. It begins this way in Matthew 17, verse 1. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, those are the three closest, the brother of James, and led them up to a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured. There's our word, metamorphosized is the Greek, the word we get from the Greek. He was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. And just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah, and they're talking with Jesus. This is an extraordinary occasion. It's an occasion that's given to just a few. It's an occasion so significant, all three writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, put it at the center of their gospel. It's the hinge upon which everything turns. It is in many ways the climax of Jesus' revelation of who he is. And thus it's important for us to understand what is its significance, what's going on here, and what are we to gather from this. So in order to get that significance, we need to put it in context. And thankfully, that's what we do so well. We've been going through this. We can easily see how this fits into how Matthew's been flowing out for us. In verse 1, after 6 days. So this takes place 6 days after what? Well, what we studied the last 2 weeks. When we looked at Peter's confession beginning in verse 13 of chapter 16. When Jesus takes his disciples up to the northernmost border of Israel. And he asks his 12 in a private time, who do people say that I am? And Peter is the one who says, you are the Christ, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. God has blessed you with this information. You are blessed, and upon you I will build my church, and you have the keys to the kingdom, and so forth. But it's also 6 days, because on that same day, in verse 21, we come to where Matthew takes a big turn from that time on. It's only after this great confession that Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. And when Peter hears of a crucified Messiah, a suffering Savior, we all know that he says, God forbid, this can't happen. And Jesus has to say to him, get behind me, Satan. Peter just doesn't understand that this is the way that God's Messiah will inaugurate God's kingdom in and through this humility and meekness of the cross. And so it's 6 days after the events that we've just considered, Peter's confession, Peter's rebuke, the first time we've heard that Jesus is going to suffer, and the disciples have had 6 days to mull it over. And now it's after 6 days, that seventh day, and all of a sudden this event takes place, which we call the Transfiguration. And if you notice, Matthew has a hard time describing it. He uses a word transfigured, metamorphosis. His face shone like the sun. And that's just a way of saying, here's a metaphor. It's so brilliant, if you can imagine. And they know the sun very well. They don't have air condition. They know what it's like to be under the beating rays of the sun and how you can't look directly upon it. or it'll just wipe you out. But this is such a bright light, that's all they can compare it to. We might, as moderns, compare it to a nuclear blast or just something so stunning that we can't look it straight in the eye. And then he says, not only did his face shine like the sun, but his clothes became as white as the light. Mark, when he tries to describe this, says that his clothes became whiter than any bleach can make them. Luke, when he tries to describe this, says it's like a lightning flash. So they all have different ways to try to communicate the incommunicable. They can't really wrap their heads around it. There's no real words for this because the divine glory is not just emanating on Jesus, it's emanating from him. He is like this sun in their presence, and it is overwhelming. And Peter, being the kind of guy that he is, has to try to put some words on what's going on. And can you blame him? It's just an experience. And he'd been so much better off if he'd done a Keanu Reeves, whoa, which I think would have been better than his response, which is verse 4, Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it's good for us to be here." The understatement of perhaps all time. You know, it's good to be here. It's just great to be here. We're having a great time, Jesus. "If you wish, I'll put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." I will memorialize this moment, put up three shelters, and we'll put you and Moses and Elijah, because Moses is a great leader, a great hero of the people of Israel, perhaps the greatest leader. Elijah is definitely the greatest prophet, held in the highest esteem. He didn't even die according to the prophets and the scriptures. He was taken into heaven on a chariot of fire. And so Peter sees all three and says, "You know, I'm going to make a shelter, a memorial for all three of you." But that's not good enough. And the reason why that's not good enough is because God has some words to say. And this is only the second time we'll hear God directly speak. The first time, you might remember, was the baptism. At Jesus' baptism, a voice came from heaven, something like a dove descended, and a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased," which is God putting God's stamp of approval on Jesus before he's done any of his ministry. Now we get that same cadence, those same words, with one notable addition. Verse 5, "While he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped him," so the sun gets even brighter, and now there's this cloud of glory overwhelming them. "And the voice from the cloud said, 'This is my Son, whom I love. With him I'm well pleased.' And one command, listen to him." We want to really wrestle with that one command. On Mount Sinai, God gave 10 commands. Here we are on another mount with another theophany, another manifestation of God's glory and a declaration of God's will. And those 10 commands are summarized down to one thing now. Listen to him. Well, in order to get at the heart of what's going on here, I always like doing this, and you've seen this before if you've been with me for a number of years. I love Eastern Orthodox iconography. I can never say that word. They're icons. And with their iconography, you have a way of demonstrating this scene before us. There's Moses, there's Elijah, you have the three disciples here, one's falling down. We haven't seen them fall down yet. They're going to, or maybe we have. When they heard the voice, verse 6, our next verse, you're going to see them fall down. Up to this point, they've been watching and observing and being overwhelmed. And then you have the way the Eastern Orthodox show the glory of God, a theophany, a manifestation of God's presence. And that two overlapping circles that almost forms an oval is called a mandorla. And a mandorla usually has either deep blue or very, very dark blue, or it's just completely, utterly black. And it's a way of representing that the glory is emanating. And it's not just any glory, it's the glory of God. I like the black a little bit better than the blue, and the reason why is the mystics used to talk quite often of the ray of darkness. That God gives us rays of darkness, which is to say, it is light so bright that it's impenetrable mystery, and it's to us a ray, but it's a ray of darkness. It's deepest, most profound mystery. It's indescribable, uncontainable, as we just sang. It truly is getting at the depths of when we say, "How great thou art." We're always dealing with a God that is far beyond anything we can imagine or think, because God is no thing. God is beyond things. God is beyond all. And so we have this incredible way of presenting the divine glory, and it's emanating not from Moses and not from Elijah, as you'll notice. They get their halos, which is a way of showing that they are saints and sacred, and Jesus has his halo as well. But only Jesus has the mandorla. And so after this vision, the disciples are overwhelmed. When the disciples, verse 6, heard this, now they've heard the voice of God, they fall face down to the ground terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, said, "Get up, don't be afraid," which, wonderful words. I always love when Jesus says, "Don't be afraid," because that's exactly where I'd be. I mean, I'd be in utter, utter fear. I'm hearing the divine voice. I'm seeing a divine manifestation of glory. It's awe-inspiring, and it's also terrorizing. There's just this absolute sense of deep and utter humility in the presence of it, an awareness that God is all, and I am nothing, you know, infinitely small compared to God. And this is the God with whom I say I want to have a relationship. Verse 7, but Jesus came, touched them, said, "Get up, don't be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except for Jesus. And then this is the after story. Verse 9, as they're coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." So they're to keep this secret among themselves because it can't be understood until after the resurrection. And that's important for us because we're seeing something that is a preview of coming attractions. We're seeing what theologians call a proleptic vision, which means it's a vision that occurs, that foreshadows the end, that shows us where everything is going, but the end hasn't quite yet arrived yet. So that we are seeing a preview of the kingdom, which is exactly how this text has been set up before us. If you go back before we began, the last verse of chapter 16, after Jesus says, "If you want to follow me, deny yourself, take up your cross," and all of that. Verse 28, "I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom." Almost all scholars would say this is those few seeing the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. That Matthew has set it up so that you see the very next story is it's just three disciples, it's not all 12, and they are now experiencing a foretaste of kingdom glory. They are seeing the glory that Jesus has been bringing to them and to their lives and to the people around them for so many years, but now the veil's being drawn back and they get to see what's really going on. It's far deeper and far more profound than they ever could imagine. But before they see the fullness of that glory in all that it contains, they've got to go down the mountain into the valley of suffering, rejection, betrayal, humiliation, death. And it's only then and after then, with the glory of the resurrection, that they'll begin to piece together how it is that this glory is demonstrated in our world. It's not demonstrated with God overpowering us through Jesus, with that glory emanating in everyone's presence, so everyone just bows and says, "Oh my gosh, whoa." It is a humble glory. It is a glory represented in meekness and in identifying with suffering. It's different than they could ever imagine, and we continue to wrestle with what that might mean for us in our lives. So as we work through the significance of this transfiguration, trying to piece together what's going on, one of the things that's clearly going on here is Jesus is being presented in a very unique fashion, that He is different from and yet in union with or continuity with the greatest leader and the lawgiver and with the greatest prophet, and yet He's identified or earmarked by God as, "Listen to Him." The voice from heaven doesn't say, listen to Moses, even though Moses is having a great discussion with Jesus, which means they're in continuity, they're not in conflict. He doesn't say, listen to Elijah the prophet, although they is also having a discussion with Jesus. He identifies Jesus, and one of the reasons that happens is I think you have something unique going on that any good Hebrew would see. You're having, in many ways, another representation of a theophany on a mountain. And they would think back to one of their greatest theophanies, Mount Sinai. And it was there on the mountain that God proclaimed God's will, where God said, listen to these Ten Commandments. Now we're on another mountaintop, and what's even more interesting, when you come to that actual text in Exodus, the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the cloud. Well, chapter 17, verse 1, after 6 days, which means on the seventh day, God speaks from the cloud. So we're having another time where this is being presented, but instead of the voice declaring the 10 words or the 10 commandments, the voice declares, listen to him. And then when Moses comes down the mountain, it's said that his face glowed with glory. He had an after effect of glory for quite a while, but it would always fade because the glory didn't emanate from him. It was transferred to him, and then it would slowly fade. What we've seen here that's different is the glory actually has emanated from Jesus, highlighting his uniqueness. His uniqueness from Moses, his uniqueness from Elijah, both great men, both great heroes of Israel. Jesus isn't in conflict with them, but he has come to do, and this is the key word of Matthew, I have come to fulfill the law and the prophets. Do not think I came to abolish the law or the prophets, but I've come to fulfill them. And he's identified here as the true fulfillment of all that God had planned in and through God's servant Moses and in and through God's servant Elijah. And yet he stands at the end as the one in whom the law and the prophets have been uniquely fulfilled. He indeed comes in light of what Moses had said about someone that would eventually come. It's always interesting to me, Moses himself in Deuteronomy, which is a series of sermons that he gives at an old age to the people of Israel right before they enter into the Promised Land. It's the last book of Moses. And in one of those sermons, he tells the people, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. And Matthew, if nothing else, is how Jesus is a prophet like Moses, though better. He will raise a prophet like me from among your own people, the people of Israel. And guess what? You better listen to him. These are the words of Moses, that there's coming someone like me out of Israel, a prophet that the Lord will raise. And Moses doesn't in any way say, what God has said to us is the final word. And that's all we need. Just the Ten Commandments and we're just fine. Instead, God through Moses says, there's another coming. And you better listen to him. And so what we have here is that being fulfilled in a very, very strong way. And I think that phrase, listen to him, is the one that I hope resonates with you because it's the new phrase. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased, we've heard before. And that's just a rubber stamp on what we've first seen in the baptism. But now the divine voice says, listen to him. Listen to what? Well, for sure, the fact that in the previous text he had said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be betrayed and be killed and be rejected, but he'll be raised again. So they must listen to the fact, and the early church will understand this, that suffering and weakness and humiliation, that's the way of the cross. If we're to follow Christ, what that means is we'll walk in a way of humility, in a way that doesn't guarantee triumph, but might actually involve suffering and identification with other suffering and great, great sorrow. So that's one of the things we're to listen to so that we understand. But I think it's best to see listen to him. And that takes us all the way back to the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus officially begins teaching. And from that other mountain, he gives, you've heard it said among you, thou shalt not murder. And he's quoting Moses, but I say unto you. And so the words of the sermon, the missionary call, the kingdom parables, and a few more sections we're about to look at in Matthew, we're to listen to and to consider as having the greatest esteem and the highest value when it comes to God's revelation. Because God, at this point, has reduced everything that God's will is to one thing. Listen to Him. Follow Him. Trust Him. Go in His way. He's got it right. He's the great one. Not Moses. Moses was great. He's my beloved son. Elijah's fantastic, but he's the prophet Moses spoke of that would come and you're to listen to. And so listening to him becomes important. It is the reason why all good Christian theologians interpret everything from the old in light of Christ. You have to understand that there are some things that are irrelevant to us, some things that have been superseded, some things that are of no value anymore, other things that are of great value, but now we see them through the lens of Christ. Don't murder, but if you call your brother a fool, you're worthy of the fires of hell. That some things get more intensified, and we need to think about what's behind some of these laws. But we're to view everything through the lens of Christ. Because at the end of the day, what we've got in this wonderful transfiguration is not just a revelation of Christ, but a preview of things to come. And one of the reasons Peter, John, and James are given this vision is to give them strength to endure as they move toward that cross that we're going to be moving toward as we continue to read through the Gospel of Matthew. They need to remember that no matter how much Jesus suffers and is betrayed and is rejected, that He's the glorious one. He is God's beloved Son. That He will be raised. And that's why you get that at verse 9. Don't tell anyone until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. And so it's interesting when you begin to see and realize that Jesus is just as glorious on the cross as He is at the Transfiguration, that you can begin to do something that is very interesting. You can compare the Transfiguration with what's going on at the cross, and you see that both are very similar experiences. Now, the way I've drawn this up here, here's an Eastern icon of the Transfiguration. There's our cross, and this is Jesus rising from the dead. All right, so that's kind of the movement. Whereas Matthew 17, Matthew 26, 27, Matthew 28, Jesus risen. And there's a mandorla, by the way, with the deep black in the background. So you can see that it's showing that sense of divine glory. But when you compare the Transfiguration to the cross, it's interesting. Both take place on mountains. At the Transfiguration, you have a mountain, and Jesus is revealed in glory. At the cross, He is on the hill of the skull, and He's revealed in shame. So you have glory versus shame. At the Transfiguration, you have three witnesses, Peter, John, and James. At the cross, you have three witnesses, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, and Salome the mother of John. So we have another three and three. At the Transfiguration, His clothes are shining white with glory. At the cross, Jesus is stripped of His clothes, and they represent no more than a few pennies for those gambling for His clothes. At the Transfiguration, Jesus is surrounded by two, Moses and Elijah, the greatest heroes of Israel's history. At the cross, Jesus is surrounded by two, the lowest of the low, brigands, rogues, thieves. At the Transfiguration, Jesus is speaking to Elijah. At the cross, crowds mock and say, "Let Elijah save him if God is well pleased with him." So they speak of Elijah, but they say, let's see whether Elijah will save him or not. At the Transfiguration, a bright cloud overshadows the scene. At the cross, darkness for 3 hours, complete and utter darkness. And at the Transfiguration, Jesus hears the words, and so do the disciples, "This is my beloved Son." At the cross, it's only through mockery. He said He was God's Son. And it's not till the end, after He's died, that a Roman centurion will say, "Surely this was the Son of God." The one you never expect to say anything like that. So one of the things that you see when you compare the two, and you see how they compare and contrast in many powerful ways, is the church is reflecting the idea that the glory of Christ is still on display at the cross. It's just you with faith have to see that there's glory in the cross. It's not like that glory that was there at the Transfiguration has been lost. It is God's glory in its fullest power, but it's now not being demonstrated by this emanation of transfiguration. It is being demonstrated by the humility and weakness of crucifixion. And that's why Christians so often and so powerfully will talk about the power of the cross, the glory of the cross. It's the cross that shows us the goodness, the love, the power, the greatness, the humility, the patience of God, the forgiveness of God, and on you go. So you have this preview of coming attractions, and it allows us to endure that cross and realize the one who's hanging on the cross is the same one who emanates God's glory and the one who will emanate it again. For he himself understands, I'm going to be betrayed, I'll be crucified, but I'll be raised. And when I'm raised, then you can tell everybody this vision, because then you'll start to get it. You'll understand the significance of it. It's not just to show how glorious I am. It's to show that that glory is still there for those who can see with eyes of faith at the cross. And because that glory is a glory that God has promised to share with those whom God not only justifies and sanctifies, but also glorifies, we begin to realize this is not just a preview of coming attractions for the cross and for the resurrection Christ, but there's a reason why a few chapters back Jesus said this, the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of the Father. Now that's amazing. Jesus' face shone like the sun. But previous to this, he'd already said that the righteous, and he's quoting from Daniel, actually, Daniel chapter 12, that the righteous will shine like the sun. And that's important to remember, because this is the destiny that the Scriptures constantly give for those who are righteous, for those who walk in the ways of God, and for Christians, for those in the way of Christ. That's why you read in 1 John 3, when Jesus appears, we shall be like him. Or in Philippians, Paul will say, the Lord Jesus will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of his glory. Or the one verse that defines and controls everything I do as a pastor, in my teaching pastorate, in my role as teacher, that all of us, Paul says, with unveiled faces, beholding the glory of the Lord as in a mirror, mirrors made of bronze, often a distorted vision, but at least a true one, although it's not all and it's not clear. As we look at the glory of the Lord, even if it's not quite as clear as it should be, as we continue to do that, that's what is the agent to transform us into that image of Christ from one degree of glory to another. There's no one verse that more defines my understanding of gospel preaching than to say, we must see Jesus. We must see his glory. His glory is not always this special effects laid in transfiguration. The glory is also on the darkness of the cursed tree. That there's a glory in everything he does. And the more we can see that, the more we reflect it ourselves. And then we are transformed inwardly into that same way. So that you get this wonderful vision of a humanity that in God's program and plan is not just a bunch of ordinary folk. You instead get this idea that God's intention for humankind being made in God's image is that we might reflect the divine image in the same way that Jesus does. Now, Jesus is unique. He's the unique beloved Son. Glory emanates from him. But we are told that we will share in that, that we will reflect it as best and as uniquely and as each one of us can, which is why, as we look at that preview of coming attractions to where the world's going and where salvation takes us, we're to live like that now. We're to embrace that in the presence. And I know, you know, this is a Jenny passage all the way. You are light of the world. Shine bright. That whole idea that already in the Sermon on the Mount, he's told his disciples, you're the light. And if you hide that light, then people won't know. You're the light. Or one of my favorites, Philippians 2, shine like stars in the world. But if you hear the context and you just have to listen, Paul writes, do all things without grumbling and complaining, so that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation in which you shine like stars in the world. What's the key there? It's very interesting to me. It's not all the big ones that we want to, you know, get in a tiff and a huff about. Do all things without grumbling and complaining. Because if you do that, then you'll shine in this world that is crooked and perverse. And if we begin to go in that direction, that's what God has ordained for us, and that's the direction God's salvation is taking us, then the next step is to realize that's where God would like to take the world. And that's where the quote from Lewis that I've shared with you before from his Weight of Glory to me is so valuable. His book is a collection of sermons, and one of those sermons is called The Weight of Glory, but the book is called The Weight of the Glory, but it's just one sermon. He talks about the responsibility we all share. Because if we truly believe that God's intention is to make us to share in and to shine the image of Christ, that's an incredible responsibility. And so Lewis writes, "It is in light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with awe and circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You've never talked to a mere mortal. It is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses, for in him or her also Christ is truly hidden." Now that's a great weight. It demands that you have honor and respect and show dignity to others, to all made in the divine image, friend and enemy. And that's why I want to conclude with this, because once you take that into the realm of not just believers who are shining the light, and we're shining it for the sake of those we're trying to bear witness to, but this sense that this is where God's taking everything, you come close to this revelation that my favorite writer of all time, Thomas Merton, there's no more favorite. He is at the top of the list. Everyone else begins at like 5, 6, and 7 because he's 1 through 4. He is the most interesting, most profound person I've ever read. He is deeper than I can know, and every time I read him, I'm inspired and just blessed. He, in 1958, in Louisville, Kentucky, of all places, Louisville, Kentucky, had a vision he writes about in his book, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. And that vision was so profoundly alluring to the people of Kentucky, they put a monument up to it. Let's build a shelter here. You know, they put their own monument up for this vision that he had. So here's the monument Peter could never make. And it says, "Merton had a sudden insight at this corner, March 18th, 1958, that led him to redefine his monastic identity with greater involvement in social justice issues. He was," and there they quote from his writing, "suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people. He found them," quote, "walking around shining like the sun." He had this vision, and if you read deeper into what he says and you don't just get that quote, which I think is a little misleading because he didn't just focus on social justice issues. If you read his writings, he's a deep theologian the whole time, and he always stayed in his hermitage. He loved his hermitage. And you know what a hermitage is? It's all alone, writing books. So it's not like he was this great, great protester or went out and did these great works of activism. He just began to realize, if God's trying to glorify me, and God is going to glorify my fellow monks, and God's trying to glorify the Catholic Church, which he was a part of, and if God's trying to glorify the Christian people, what if I extend that vision to the whole world? And he began, while he was at that corner, to see all people shining. And if you read the actual statement he makes, it gets, I think, a little bit more powerful. He writes about this vision, "It is a glorious destiny to be a member of the human race. Now I realize what we all are. I have the immense joy of being man, a member of a race in which God himself became incarnate. As if the sorrows and stupidities of the human condition could overwhelm me, now that I realize what we all are. And if only everybody could realize this. But it cannot be explained," which is true. It goes beyond words. "There is no way of telling people that they're all walking around shining like the sun. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other." And he concludes by saying, "But this cannot be seen, only believed and understood by a peculiar gift, the gift of the Spirit. I have no program for this seeing. Can't make it happen. It is only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere. And so at the corner of 4th and Walnut, he saw the gate of heaven. And I would hope that as we wrestle with what God is doing through this unique Christ and where God is bringing us, that we might be able to see that here we are at the corner of 5th and Walnut. And maybe it can move over one block, although it's another city altogether. Maybe another city, maybe even further. That we would retain this vision, but like Merton says, we have to believe it in order to see it. It's not something you can scientifically make someone think. It's not something you can argue them into. It is a vision that you must have, and it's a vision you must embrace. And what I find amazing about the Transfiguration, it's a vision of God's glory expressed through Jesus' humanity that the church so deeply embraced, it made it the heart of three Gospels and said, this is what God is doing. This is what God is doing in Christ, and this is where God is bringing the people of God in Christ, and this is the mission of those people to shine as lights, to be a bright, shining star in this world, that we might participate in and partake of and be driven by that vision so much so that it allows us to testify by not grumbling or complaining, by beginning to see people through the eyes of Christ, for the honor and dignity, the respect, the love they deserve as being immeasurably valuable to God, whether they are to us or not. I want to close with a poem. I don't usually close with poems, so cut me some slack here. It's a short one. Jay Janda. I forget what the lady's name is. But she says, you cannot change others, no. But you can see them with new eyes. Christ eyes. Who sees all with respect and understanding. And I think if we started to enter into making this vision the vision that drives us, we'd realize our purpose isn't to try to change everybody. It's to first begin by seeing them through the eyes of Christ. Seeing them in light of the salvation of God. Seeing them in light of this transfiguration vision that so informs us not only of the unique blessedness of our Christ, but of where that Christ is leading us and how that glory can be demonstrated in weakness and suffering and humility, how it may be there underneath the veil where we don't even expect it to be. Would you pray with me?